This is James Corbett, and you're tuned into CorbettReport.com on the first day of June 2011, and joining me from my home and native land is previous guest of the Corbett Report, Denis Roncourt, who, of course, is available at activistteacher.blogspot.com. He was a former tenured professor of physics at the University of Ottawa, who was put on academic suspension and banned from campus for daring to not only teach a course on activism, but to actually try to implement those activist ideologies in the classroom. Denis Roncourt, it's great to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, James. I'm happy to be here. I want to just clarify that I was first suspended, trespassed from campus, arrested by Ottawa police, handcuffed, taken to the police station when I dared to continue doing my activities, although I was still a tenured and full professor at the time. And then I was later fired. So this is the first firing of a tenured professor in memory in a long time here in Canada. And it's presently one of the large academic freedom cases that we're dealing with in this country.
Well, I'm thankful for that clarification, because it is sort of a long and winding story, and I do want to get into that in some detail today, because it is quite fascinating the way all of this unfolded. But I imagine it started sometime once upon a time when you were a mild-mannered physics professor, but I don't know where it actually started. So why don't we get into this and find out a little bit more about how all of this developed?
Well, I've never been meek and mild-mannered. I've always been sort of the classic angry young man, trying to find my place in the world and making my way. But I was thoroughly indoctrinated into the career path of the academic physicist. There's no doubt about that, and I suffered a lot from that. I mean, the indoctrination process, which includes the graduate studies, the PhD, postdoctoral work. The tenure track, all of that, that career path is a very rigid personality control apparatus that has a terrible effect on one's person. So I was subjected to that, and it was successful. I was a working so-called rising star physicist, getting large research grants and teaching my courses and so on. But because I never the indoctrination was never quite complete, there were always cracks and places where I was trying to find my way and recover my old self, eventually I was able to find venues within the university where I could start to express dissidence. So one venue was a course that I developed, which is called Physics and the Environment. And I was given a free hand in that course. It was in a new environmental studies program. And so I decided to bring in politicians, activists, all kinds of societal players that would motivate the learning of the physics and the environmental science. And it just grew from there. And it allowed me to expand and experiment with pushing the limits in a way. And it eventually led to, in 2005, what I called academic squatting, which was to take over this course completely and allow the students and the professor, myself, together to define what it was going to be and how it was going to satisfy our needs and exactly how we wanted to use it in our education. And the administration flipped out when they saw that I was doing this, that I'd opened the class to the community, that I allowed everyone to come into the classroom who wanted to. So there was all kinds from the community. We filled a large auditorium, and we applied a very novel pedagogical methods, parallel work groups. The students were deciding the curriculum as they went. There was a lot of vibrant discussion. It was a real life-changing experience for many students, and it generated so much enthusiasm that the students wanted to have their own officially recognized activism course in the university curriculum. So they fought to create an activism course. And the reason they felt they needed to do that was that this academically squatted course was resisted quite strongly by the administration. I mean, the dean of the Faculty of Science barged into the second class of that course and you know, announced that it was over, that if they had to, they would replace me and so on. And the students said, we don't think so. And you have to realize that, you know, the great majority of activists on campus and in the community were in that room when the dean tried to intervene like that and shut it down. So there was a battle, and the students won, and the course was given as we had intended. And then I was disciplined for that. And that discipline went to arbitration, and so it went to court, and I won the arbitration. I was awarded a significant victory that established that it was under the purview of my academic freedom to bring in activists into the classroom to motivate the learning, and that all the pedagogical methods that I had applied were protected under the purview of academic freedom. So it was a quite significant precedent-setting case. But it turns out that very few of my colleagues have the backbone to actually use those freedoms in their classes. But it was the beginning also of a battle, because the university was rather upset that I was being resistant and resilient in this way. And it just went on from there. So the students fought to get this activism course, and they won. It was a huge battle. They put us through 16 committees. They were making up committees as we were going along. The students would go into all the committee meetings and impose their speech about why they wanted this course and so on. And it was approved officially at the last hour, and it was given in 2006, the fall of 2006, in the largest auditorium on campus at the University of Ottawa. And in fact, Malala Joya, a member of parliament from Afghanistan, a young woman, opened the first class of that activism course. And it was there was over 500 people in attendance in the media and so on. And it was a joyous event. I mean, it was a very intense event also, because we learned about from someone who directly was coming from Afghanistan, the reality of Canada's war in Afghanistan and how it was definitely doing more harm than good. And she actually expressed and gave examples of how under the U.S.-Canadian occupation and under those war conditions, the situation was actually worse for the population and women and children than it had been under the Taliban. So, I mean, it was pretty dramatic to hear that. And it just shows you what these wars are about. So it just went from there. The university was very unhappy with how this new course was progressing, but they had approved it, and we had it. But then so much activism was generated as a result of that course. So many things were transformed and were catalyzed on campus that the administration just never allowed the course to be given again after that first year. And it just goes on from there. I have never backed down when I believe that it was a question of my professional independence, my professional responsibility, and my academic freedom. And as a result, and the university has only one tool in their toolbox, and that's the hammer. So they were bashing me as hard as they could, trying to put me in my place, and I was simply resisting and continuing to do what I thought was the right thing, what I still believe was the right thing. And I mean, I have a lot of evidence to that effect. So that, in a nutshell, is at least the first years of this tremendous battle. And then I was fired in 2009. And my case is presently before the courts. My dismissal case is before the courts, you know, as we speak. And it's expected that the hearings will take about a year from this point on.
Oh, the wonderful web of the Canadian justice system as the gears grind and grind. Well, it is a fascinating story, and it is it probably shouldn't be such a revolutionary idea to have people deciding to actually learn together in an environment where there is no hierarchical teacher-student relationship and none of those traditional boundaries, but it is unfortunately a very revolutionary idea. And you're right, so few of your academic brethren have come to your aid. Why is that?
I think, in a word, I guess I would say fear. You know, the control, the ideological control within academia is very strong, and the degree of indoctrination is very high. And so the one thing that professors learn as they're being put through the tenure track is never step out of line. In other words, you get tenure because you've demonstrated that you will never use it, that you'll never actually say anything that would cause your employer to want to fire you. So that system is very efficient, much more efficient than straight up totalitarian systems. You know, where the police are at the classroom door and so on. It's much more efficient than that because the indoctrinated professional adopts the ideology of the system and projects it. So there's that, and there's the fear. I mean, the fear to be identified by the university administration as someone who sides with me. I mean, There was a very brave professor of psychology who became the chairman of my support committee, who publicly sided with me, and he was he suffered consequences as a result of that, all kinds of consequences and attempts to discipline him and so on. So it's immediate and it's real if you stick your neck out. And the university environment is pretty ferocious in that sense. I mean, I could give you even just one very recent example at Queen's University, which is a two-hour drive from Ottawa. I have a colleague who tried to blow the whistle and has been blowing the whistle on academic fraud, falsification of academic data, false scientific results being published in numerous scientific journals, a very large case that he's trying to expose and that he's has exposed to funding agencies and to the government and so on. And as a result, now that he's trying to make that public and to really inform his colleagues on campus, he was recently, just very recently, told that he was barred under the threat of being arrested by police from going to certain buildings on campus, that he was barred from using email to communicate with his colleagues and so on. In a letter from the vice president academic directly telling him that it's because he's sending these emails, making people aware of these happenings. Now, of course, the pretext they use is that some people are feeling unsafe as a result of receiving these emails that simply clearly state what is happening, that give links to evidence and to media reports about this whole event. So it shows you just how obscene things have become here in Canada in the academic world.
Obscene is unfortunately a very good word for it. And I think it's for people looking from the outside, looking into academia, it is somewhat ironic at the very least that that the sector of the economy, and unfortunately that's really what academia is these days, it's just another sector of the economy, that spends and devotes the most time to actually thinking about revolutionary ideologies and practices actually is one of the least revolutionary institutions around. It's kind of a bizarre dualism going on.
Oh, it's not only one of the least revolutionary institutions, it's also an institution that ensures that students do not become revolutionary. It's an institution that takes in students and molds them and squeezes out anything that would be original or resemble any kind of dissidence or rebellion. Even the so-called activist professors are people who are expert at taking activist students and indoctrinating them. So they turn them towards these pursuits related to analysis of the problem. They turn them to theory, and they project these myths of the type, the pen is mightier than the sword, and a great idea can transform the world, and all of this stuff. Whereas really, I mean, the reality is it's a hierarchy of dominance. That's the world we live in. And the only way to get any kind of justice for people within that hierarchy is to resist it and to fight back. And so students who would be inclined to do that are sucked in literally by these progressive activist professors and molded into becoming these neutralized academics who analyze and who write about and who speak truth to power on all this kind of crap. So it's really a very efficient machine to maintain the status quo and to ensure that no one steps out of line.
It begs the question then, if you had been allowed to continue with your activism course unfettered, if it's possible to really establish a space, a revolutionary space in that type of institution, even if it was unfettered by the administration.
You mean that, if I understand you correctly, you mean that their students are subjected to so many other courses into their program, they're so brought into the machine that a single course could not make a difference? Is that what you mean?
Well, that's part of it, I think. The context, obviously, the greater context of the academic setting itself. But I think also just the idea of being in a classroom and having people come in to talk about it or whatever. I wonder if there is a way to carve out a revolutionary space within that framework.
Oh, I think there clearly is. And, you know, there are very good examples of that in recent history. I mean, if you look at what was happening in the 60s and 70s, there were teach-ins, there were sit-ins, there were the culture was such that it was a more rebellious culture. And the culture was such that there were authentic professors who allowed that space to be created within their classrooms and who protected it to some degree. So this was much more the case in the 60s, and there are many, many examples of that that are well documented. And you know, there was a huge effort throughout the 80s and 90s and so on to squeeze that completely out of our schools. I mean, schools in Canada have undergone a transformation that I would ascribe to a march towards corporate fascism. It's been quite noticeable. If you look at high schools in Ontario, for example, they were simply gutted. I mean, teachers were taken, their professional independence was completely removed from them. They were taken away from time to prepare the class, responsibility over what the teaching methods were going to be and what the content was going to be. It was all centralized. They became just cogs in a machine. There's high degrees of depression among teachers. They have no time for anything else. They're in survival mode. The students, of course, suffer from that because it means there's no discourse. There's no exchange with adults in the classroom. There is, you know, the educational system has been transformed over the last 30 years in order to completely remove the possibility of independent thinking and of learning. And so as a result, the students who come into university, and I saw them, I taught at the university for 23 years, especially as this revolution was occurring, you could see even in the 23 years that I was there, when I was teaching first year at the beginning versus the end, there was a dramatic change in the psychology of students. I mean, you had daring students who asked daring questions even at the first class, you know, and they were eager to fight out the ideas and everything. And by the end of it, they were like brainless sheep who were just asking questions like, could you give us extra, problems to solve so we can practice more and this kind of thing. It was really sad to see that transformation. I witnessed it. So there's definitely, I think, a drive within our so-called developed societies towards corporate fascism, and to not allow these institutions to, create these kinds of spaces like you had earlier and like I was trying to create. There's like these rigid controls that get put into place. The administration's task is to identify, isolate, and destroy these so-called, you know, problem cases. And so professors are on edge. They would not dare. They understand instinctively, and they just don't go there. So the classroom has become a desert, a dead space where, their PowerPoint presentations, basically, where the professor is reading the slides off the screen and the students are doing their email on their laptops, and it's just the saddest waste of human potential you could ever see to witness these classrooms. It's very, very sad.
It is sad, and that change that you note is one that has been lamented by quite a few observers of education over the years, and it is one that I think is demonstrably taking place, but it does raise the question of whether there is agency behind this change, and if so, how, who, and why is this being implemented?
Yeah, well, I you know, they don't let us into the boardrooms and secret meetings. They don't, we're not privy to what's going on in the higher spheres of power that control the economy and so on. But clearly one gets a sense that there a lot of people are benefiting from this kind of move towards fascism. I mean, and I don't mean benefiting in a purely economic profit sense, because I think it's a myth to think that it's all about, that corporations are all about optimizing profit. I think that's a lie. I think what it's really about is control and dominance. This is of much greater concern to corporate and finance masters than profit, because profit is meaningless. They're concerned about the real economy. They're concerned about controlling the real resources, labor resources and natural resources, and keeping control over populations. I mean, that's really what drives them. And they know, I think, instinctively, all the cogs within that hierarchy of dominance understand that you cannot have free agents, that you cannot have professional independence, that you cannot have actual learning and independent thinking. And so they find ways instinctively, I think, to drive it out of people. And I think there's a big movement in that direction. It's almost... I think it's instinctive. It's because the pathology has already taken foot on the planet. That pathology supports itself. That's my macro understanding of it, you know. But I certainly wish I could be in those board meetings.
Certainly. Well, how about the development of different ideas of pedagogy over the years, and how, for example, the Prussian schooling system and others have been gradually grafted onto ones that were previously existing in our society? I mean, what kind of historical developments do you see taking place that have brought us to this point?
Do you mean the development of pedagogy itself?
Well, yes, that, and also the implementation of education systems in the classroom itself. I mean, all aspects of it, really.
Well, I mean, the history of the modern public school is a well-known one. I mean, it directly derives from military needs, right? I mean, it started in Prussia. I mean, I'm sure you've covered this on your show previously, but the Prussians realized that the French were able to conquer them so easily because they had schools for their military officers. And under occupation, they were not allowed to have a military, but they were allowed to organize schools. And so they did. And the goal of these schools was to instill national fervor and a sense of serving the nation. And that led to Prussia being, for a long time, one of the most powerful empires around. And so other developing modern states noticed this and came to study the Prussian educational system and then implemented it in the US and Canada and so on. So the history of that is really well known. And the designers of the system understood quite well what it was about. It was about having an obedient workforce. So the bells, breaking up of the day in order to break up concentration, to not allow a natural flow of thinking and so on. All of these were explicitly described in how the schools were designed. It's only later under, because society, liberal society likes to mask its historical truth, where these ideas that schools were about personal development, that was sort of grafted onto this school system later, and it's a complete lie. It was never intended that way. It wasn't designed that way, and its structure is such. It is opposite to personal development and to learning, efficient learning, and so on. So, I mean, that's the history of it. And it's well known. It's been described by many people, such as John Taylor Gatto and others, you know. Is that what you meant?
Well, that was along the lines, but perhaps then we can go more into the philosophy of education and learning itself then.
Well, I think learning, you know, the discoveries of pedagogy that were well described are fairly old. I mean, a lot of this stuff was developed and written about very clearly in the 60s and 70s. I think the most influential pedagogy is that of Paulo Freire. He wrote a landmark book that was entitled Pedagogy of the Oppressed, or Pedagogy of Liberations, others call it. In North America, we call it Critical Pedagogy. So this was a landmark book that explained how true learning occurs and how it needs to be based in an environment such as ours, where we're subjected to a dominance hierarchy. True learning needs to be based in authentic rebellion. In other words, the student needs to discover within themselves an authentic rebellion. Otherwise, they will fall apart and go into self-destruction and all kinds of behaviors, or they'll adopt the ideology and destroy themselves that way, the ideology of the system. So this authentic rebellion is what motivates what Paulo Freire called the praxis of liberation. And by praxis, he means that you are acting to fight against your own oppression, and that action causes the system to respond. There's a backlash, so it informs you about the true nature of the system. That causes you to analyze what's going on, to reflect. Because you're being subjected to this backlash, your reflection is particularly keen. And you're particularly you learn very quickly under those circumstances, and then you think of what your next action is going to be to protect yourself and to push your liberation further. So this is called the praxis of liberation. And Paulo Freire explained that, you know, this is how true learning occurs, and he applied this to teach literacy to peasants in Latin America with great success, and he developed this whole pedagogy around that. So he found that the greatest barrier when it comes to this kind of learning is that the slave, whether you're talking about wage slavery or actual slaves that he was working with in Latin America in the 70s, the biggest barrier to learning is that the slave does not acknowledge that they're a slave. They don't recognize it. They will say things like, we need the master, he protects us, he organizes our work, where would we be without, you know, this structure, basically. So the pedagogy involves exercises that catalyze an awareness about this condition that the slaves are being subjected to, and then initiates this praxis that I was describing. So I think that's the most powerful pedagogical theory that's ever been developed, and it's the one that I have been trying to apply for years in my classrooms. So I've been applying it in a first world context where it's about what is being oppressed or suppressed from us is our political agency. So students and members of society are not allowed to have influence in society. The structures are such that it's completely removed from us, and therefore that is a strong type of oppression for middle classers, let's say, in the first world, since that's the category I'm in, and since Paulo Freire explained, and I believe this, that you can, when you're fighting for justice, you can only fight your own oppression. So you have to fight from where you're at, from your class position, given the advantages you have. You fight that hierarchy of dominance against your own oppression, and all of those struggles coalesce and cross classes eventually as you bring that dominance pyramid down. So by applying that, I would apply it in the classroom to students. Now, that there were even homeless people in some of my classrooms, because I would open it to the community. So I was trying to find ways that everyone could fight their own oppression, and how we could share stories about it and so on, in order to learn what we needed to learn to do that. And you find that you learn very quickly, whether it's legal things, theoretical knowledge, whatever you need to liberate yourself, you learn very efficiently and very quickly. But Paulo Freire used to give the example that when you're teaching literacy, for example, if you're looking at a laborer who's basically working under slave-like conditions, and you write a sentence on the board, which is, the land belongs to he who works it. Well, the laborer learns how to read and write very quickly when you start with sentences like that. So it connects to their lives directly and to their agency in the world and to their place in the world. And that's the kind of learning that is true and deep and connects to the person, where the knowledge really becomes part of you and you can use it to act in the world. And so that's the theory that I was trying to use, and it's well known. And, you know, the so-called critical pedagogues in North America read the same book and talk the language but don't actually apply it in the classroom. I mean, it's another one of these diversions it's a trick. I mean, you can't accept the dominance of the school administration. You can't accept the imposed structure and the fact that you're going to have authoritarian power over the students in the classroom as a prerequisite, and then apply something that you call critical pedagogy. That's just nonsense. So when pedagogues approach me and they say, you know, I agree, I read the book, that's what I try to do as well, the first question I always ask them is, do you grade your students? You know, do you have power over them? Do you impose your view on them? Or do you create a situation where they're completely free to disagree with you and where they come to understand that they can, and they can even ask you to leave the classroom while they discuss things about how the class is going to be run? You know, do you create those situations? Are you real? Are you for real? And, you know, 99% of the time, they're not for real, and the discussion stops there.
That's interesting, because I noted when I was reading through some of the media and interviews that you've done over the years, I found it interesting that the media, especially the mainstream media that's written about you or interviewed you, has really focused on the issue of grading, and it seems to be almost to the exclusion of any other issue that was brought up in this course. So I guess we should get into this a little bit. Tell people about your approach to grading in your activism course and what kind of trouble that landed you in.
Right. Well, you know, the reason the mainstream media, I think, focused on grading is twofold. One is that the university publicly said, I mean, the pretext the university used to fire me was that I had graded fraudulently, okay, that there was academic fraud how I was grading, which is completely the opposite of the situation. In fact, my grading was an integral part of my pedagogical method and was... applied very consciously as part of that pedagogical method. So that's one thing that caused the media to concentrate on that. And the other thing is that everyone who's been to school, who's been oppressed by that system, knows that the instrument of oppression is grades. So everyone can relate to grades. And the people who have survived the system want, you know, one of the first reactions of the slave is to want to be oppressed fairly. So if people have been subjected to it and they bought into it, they don't want others to get off from being subjected to exactly that kind of dominance. And so there's the slaves guard the system in a sense. And so it's a hot topic when you start to talk about grading and grades and the pedagogical method. The people who have been subjected to the most harsh indoctrinations and oppressions at school actually have come to believe, or the self-talk is that this is how they learn, this is how one learns, that you need this in order to learn. And of course the opposite is true. You don't learn this way at all. It prevents you from learning, and true authentic learning actually occurs by a completely different mechanism. So it's because I guess that the media could see that there would be broad interest in it, so they really did concentrate on that. And you're right. The alternative media, fortunately, was really interested in the pedagogical dimension of my case.
Well, then, returning to that issue, I take it that it's not insignificant that Ferrer's pedagogy developed from his experience and not the other way around.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely true. Paulo Freire himself was jailed, was thrown out of his country of origin, which was Brazil. He was exiled. He suffered serious consequences for trying to do his work, his pedagogy work of liberation, trying to find. So he was looking for the formula, the pedagogical formula that would catalyze liberation among people. Now, Latin America, this is in a rich culture of resistance that is that of Latin America, right? I mean, it's just an amazing place. It is a continent that will not be dominated. You've got the largest and most powerful empire in the world clenching that continent and insisting on exploiting it to the last bit of its human and natural resources, yet it somehow finds a way to have a Cuba and a Venezuela and a whole mess of resistance everywhere. So there was this rich culture, and it's continuing. It's a real inspiration to the rest of the world, I think. But that's the environment in which Paulo developed these theories. So it was directly as a result of the experience of defending yourself, I think.
Would that imply then that different contexts would necessarily require a different pedagogy?
I think that we're all subjected to hierarchy and to dominance through this hierarchy, and therefore I think these ideas are very general and generalizable. I mean, a lot of people don't agree with me. A lot of people argue that in the first world we are privileged and therefore we're not oppressed. I think that's wrong thinking. I suffered greatly physiologically, my health and so on, from the oppression that I was subjected to as a graduate student and as a professional, sleepless nights and so on. It's horrendous when your personality is removed from you and when you're brought to be part of a machine. I think, in fact, if you look at public health, and there are some rigorous scientific studies that have shown this unambiguously, and I've written about them in some of my essays, but the greatest causal threat to people's health is the physiological stress from dominance, from the dominance hierarchy. And these are exactly the terms that these scientific journal articles use. So that physiological stress is not just measured by the actual physical reality of the extent to which you're being oppressed, but also the extent to which you perceive yourself being oppressed. So in a society where, for example, a homeless person can easily eat from the garbage and the weather is okay and they can survive outside and they're doing well in a purely physical sense, because in that society homeless people are at the bottom of the societal pyramid, in a sense, in terms of self-image, these same people will suffer tremendous physiological stress. And this physiological stress was shown by various biochemical mechanisms to cause an attack of one's immune system, which in turn causes you to be susceptible to cancer, which is the number one killer, and has a direct impact on your cardiac functions, which is the second killer. And the third killer of people in the first world is medical error. This is the medical crew that is trying to convince us that these deaths are due to disease rather than directly a result of this dominance and how we're being treated as people. And so these people, this crew, the medical doctors, are actually the third killer. And then the fourth cause of death is there's a big gap there. It's way down. So medical doctors are right up there with cancer and heart disease. So this dominance hierarchy is very real and is killing us literally. And so under those circumstances, if you want to learn, develop, and liberate yourself, I think the only way is through a pedagogy like this where you're actually fighting back. And that fighting back is part of a person's expression, is part of growth, and it is an essential component to learning. You're not going to find out what the system is really like until you push it and it pushes you back. That's when you find out what it's really like, what its true characteristics are, and the details of how it functions and who the players are that make it function and how they operate and where they learn what they learn and so on, their psychology. This is how you learn these things, is by pushing back.
Is there then any aspect of our daily lives, any unpleasantness in our daily lives that is not directly attributable to the dominance hierarchy? And if not, then does that make that a rather meaningless distinction?
I've never asked the question that way. I'd have to think about it. I mean, sure, there are accidents. You can be hit by a meteorite. There are all kinds of, there are actual real diseases. You can be born with, a malformation of one of your organs and so on that I guess can happen by accident. There are accidents in the world that cause misery. But when you look at the misery that is from non-accidental causes, it's predominantly people doing it to other people through the mechanism of a dominance hierarchy. So I would like to concentrate on the harm that we can avoid by dismantling this dominance hierarchy, rather than ask, and in fact, that's one of the reasons I think that in the media, they always play up these natural disasters, a hurricane, a fire, a tsunami. These are wonderful because it turns attention away from the orders of magnitude greater destruction that the U.S. military is causing, and that the world economic system, the financial system is causing. All of these heavy-handed predations are destroying entire peoples on continental scales. And in order to divert our attention away from that, we'll talk about a tsunami here and some earthquakes over there and so on. But these are things that simply cannot be avoided. And the same dominance hierarchy that does most of the damage will also impede us from actually helping people who suffer from these natural disasters. And that's really disgusting to watch. For example, this has been the case recently in Haiti and so on. I think most of our analysis has to start with the skeleton of the dominance hierarchy and to visualize that, and then by learning and by fighting back to start putting flesh on the bones in order to visualize clearly what that means in your own environment, and therefore how you can fight back in your own environment and make that space that you need for yourself and for your community. I think that's the central analysis. And I think that academics like to turn us away from that analysis and towards diversions, including racism. A lot of times anti-racism supports the dominance hierarchy, is just a way of ensuring class advantage within a class without challenging the hierarchical oppression. So even things like anti-racism can be used in a way that protects and supports the dominance hierarchy, or rather than being correctly used as part of a liberation. So the system has really perverse ways of keeping us under its thumb, if you like.
Are you suggesting then that there's a false or co-opted sense of anti-racism or other such ideologies and a real one, or is it always and necessarily subjected to the dominance hierarchy?
No, I think there's a false one and a real one for sure. There is true racism. See, let me explain that thought a little more. For example, I think racism on its own and independent of the context is natural. It's part of what animals do. In other words, you try to recognize a species that is dangerous to your species. You want to be able to recognize them quickly and to avoid them or whatever. The same is true of groups within your species that are dangerous and that have a culture of attacking you and that are predacious. You want to be able to identify them. And if they look different or they behave differently or they group differently or they live in a different place, you want to be able to quickly ascertain those characteristics and be able to recognize them so you can deal with that threat, that very real threat. So in that sense, racism is a natural defense mechanism. Now, if you disallow that kind of racism, then you're protecting those who use violence and who use, because you're not allowing yourself to protect yourself from those groups by being racist in the sense that I described. You see what I mean? So to purify the language and to purify our thoughts to the extent where you can't even say, you know, the cause of this is whitey, and whitey is the problem, and so on, is obscene. You need to be able to defend yourself. Groups of people organize and exploit others, and you need to be able to see that. And often those groups are racially defined, or are class defined, or are somehow defined in these kinds of ways, and you need to spot that right away in order to protect yourself. So I find that in first world societies, a lot of middle class folks go off the deep end with racism of opinion and attitude and forget that they really need to fight against racism of action and actual physical oppression, and that they need to concentrate on that and let opinion and ideas and talk work itself out by discourse. And so when a group or within the hierarchy there's power over you, you need to fight that. But within a layer of the hierarchy, let's allow ourselves to have free expression. Let's allow ourselves to challenge ourselves in the discourse sense completely and not go off into these extremes of political correctness and purifying the language and language police and all of this kind of crap, which I think is pathological. And instead, try to recognize that we have to make an important distinction between the black person in my environment being able to challenge me and to find the courage to challenge me as a white male. That needs to be encouraged instead of asking the government to disallow anything that would look like racism, asking the power hierarchy itself to intervene. I think that's really going in the wrong direction. I think we need to discover our strengths by fighting and by discovering our personal agency and not appeal to the same system that exploits so many people and that's part of this big exploitation machine to pass all kinds of anti-expression laws and all, you know, to come into people's lives and to dictate how they're going to express themselves and so on. In other words, I have tried to explain that one needs to make a big distinction between racism of opinion and racism of actual physical exploitation, where there's a power imbalance involved, a true power imbalance, where you're physically threatened in a real way. I don't buy this myth that racism of opinion leads to genocide by some magical mechanism that no sociologist has been able to explain. I think that's a lot of crap. I think it's hierarchy and obedience and ascribing oneself within, deriving one's self-image from that hierarchy. I think that's where the problem is. And that's what leads to these huge crimes against humanity. So let's keep healthy discourse and let's protect our space for healthy discourse by having healthy discourse without bounds, without limits to expressed ideas. So when a dictator expresses to his generals that we're going to go and kill someone, that's not expression. That's organizing a genocide. But when in a group, a social group, someone expresses a racist view, that's a racist view, and that person can be directly challenged and should be directly challenged. And the only way that I think visible minorities are going to discover the strength and the power to do that challenging is to practice it. And I've been bashed on for saying, but you're a white guy, who are you to tell us that we have to fight back? You know, we're extremely oppressed compared to you. Who are you to tell us? Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to tell you. I'm going to express my opinion. That is my opinion, that you need to defend yourself. And I'm telling you, I'll be on your side. I'm someone that will jump right in there and support you in defending yourself. And authentically re-examine myself when I am challenged and so on. But I think we need to have that within our social groups and always keep an eye to fighting our oppression. So I hope I clarified my views on racism there. It's a very delicate topic.
It certainly is, and you bring up some provocative ideas, but I think I do understand to a certain extent what you're saying, and I situate that idea in something like the ways that a liberal will argue with a libertarian. And I'm thinking specifically about Rand Paul's recent run for the Senate. I'm not necessarily a supporter of Rand Paul per se, but I certainly agreed with him when Chris Matthews was trying to corner him on the idea, you're a libertarian, therefore you would not have voted for the civil rights legislation in the 1960s that stopped segregation and things like that. And the implication is that if you're a libertarian, so you think that people own their own businesses and thus can run them any way they want, then you are racist, because obviously then some people will use their businesses as racial segregation zones, and therefore you are supporting racism. Whereas to me, that's a bizarre way of thinking about it, because it seems to imply that the idea is that the government should come along and tell everyone what they can and can't do, and thus people will stop being racist, or that will contain racism somehow. Whereas it seems to me the ceding of power to government to tell businesses what they can and can't do is the ultimate ceding of power to that dominance hierarchy, and the perpetuation of not just racism, but all forms of oppression.
Yes, I agree with you. And I would add that I'm for laws and rules in cases where they can be used against the system of laws and rules. In other words, I'm all for using those tools to dismantle the system as a whole. I'm all for...
But that's dangerous argument, because that's like saying, well, of course, if these laws are for the good, then that will be great. And if we can stop racial segregation, well, that's a great thing. But those are the exact same laws that seed the idea that the government can come along and a different leader can come along and institute, under the same philosophical ideology, can institute laws that tell people, well, you must segregate, or you must do the exact opposite. I think it's playing with fire to give that kind of power to a government, however well-intentioned this or that particular government might be.
I agree with you. I agree with you completely that it's playing with fire. But at the same time, for example, I think it's illegitimate to insist that our leaders in quotation, be subjected to the same criminal laws as everybody else. You know, that's an example. In other words, if you can illustrate how corrupt the system is and just how nasty these leaders are, by bringing public pressure to ensure that criminal charges are brought against some of these people when it would be right to do so, for example, the banksters and so on, then I think we should use that. You know, we shouldn't deny ourselves these tools. The system wants to deny them from us, but we can use them to illustrate how these laws are not applied in a an equal way. I mean, I think that it's very powerful, because one of the biggest reactions of slaves is to want to be oppressed fairly. And that's guttural. I mean, it's ingrained in them if they were brought up in a hierarchy. And so that is a very strong sense that can be the beginning, the nucleus of discovery of wanting liberation. So I think we have to be flexible and nimble in our tactics and strategies, and not be dogmatic and ideological about, these sort of purist anarchist approaches, but instead do whatever you can to bring this system down. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I think it does. Well, I think we're running towards the end of the conversation, so I wanted to end on this note. I wanted to ask you whether you think that activism is teleological, whether you think there really can be a time after a dominance hierarchy where we all sit around holding hands and singing Kumbaya, or whether you think that the point of activism is the process of resistance.
The latter, for sure. I mean, I don't believe, I mean, it's a give and take battle. You know, we're going to be bringing down large sections of the hierarchy. It will automatically want to rebuild itself. The move towards corporate fascism in the educational system over the last 30 years that I described is a really good example of how the system takes back control and dominance. And I think that eventually, if we fight for it, and if, I mean, it's just absurd now. Students are on all kinds of drugs. Everybody's on medication. Everybody's going into depression. I just had a former graduate student of mine just the other day who committed suicide. It's really killing us, as I was describing earlier, with regards to our health. And so though that is a situation where it's a bomb, people can suddenly realize this and start to fight back. And that's when you take back some territory. But it's a continuous process, I believe. It's not necessarily oscillatory. There isn't an identifiable period. Things happen. People fight back. Sometimes others join in. Sometimes they don't. And that small group who fought back gets isolated and killed. All kinds of things happen. But it's a constant movement. And I believe that since we live in this hierarchy, real life is about this kind of activism where you're fighting for your own liberation, for your own human destiny to have an influence, to have a say in how the community is organized and what your role in your community is going to be. So that struggle is never going to go away. And I don't think there is an after revolution. In fact, Paulo Freire explained this beautifully. He explained how to make a revolution in such a way as to not recreate the power hierarchy. He explained that this process of liberation had to be done in such a way that you were, at the same time that you were in the physical circumstances liberating yourself, you were also removing the oppressor from within you as a person, so that you were not just going to replace the oppressor and be the oppressor. And he described that process in his book. And I think that that's extremely insightful. And I try to apply that in my own work. So I think there is a battle of personal development that has to come through this praxis of liberation, and it's got to be centered on fighting one's own oppression, not someone else's oppression, not some issue that you decide is important and that you're going to struggle to solve, but it's got to be tied, I think, personally tied to your own oppression. So that's what I believe.
Interesting. Well, a very, very serious and somewhat hopeful note to end things on. Well, Denis Rancourt, tell people about where they can go to find out more about your own case and about the topics that we've talked about today.
Well, there's a lot of background material about my own case at academicfreedom.ca, academicfreedom, one word, .ca. And you can also reach me through my blogs. There's one called Activist Teacher, And there's one where I follow the malfeasance of the University of Ottawa, and it's called U of O Watch, one word, .blogspot.com. So those are some of the popular places. If you just Google my name, you'll find lots of things, lots of ways to reach me and see the various essays that I've written and so on.
Denis Rancourt, thank you once again for your time, and I look forward to talking with you again.
It was a great pleasure, James.